If you are sitting at home next to your radio, you're hearing the music faster than you are if you're in the hall.
Listening for the secret. Searching for the sound. This is The Sound Podcast with Ira Haberman.
We'll be right back. You've been listening to Messy Mark, the first track in Marvin's latest release, Shreddin' at Sweetwater. For the unfamiliar, Marvin are a four-piece jazz rock, or more accurately, jazz fusion outfit, featuring Danny Rabin on guitar and saxophonist Danny Markovich, the principals for whom the band is named. Their blend of harmonics, grooves, and stellar solos make this a band to check out. Since Marvin is as fresh to me as it may be to you, and because I needed to know more about this awesome quartet, I got in touch with Danny Rabin to fill in some details on how the band came to be, where they are headed, and a whole lot more. First up, how the two Dannys met, which I thought was at the Berklee School of Music, but was quickly corrected.
No, the story, it's funny you say that because I have a friend in Israel who's a bassist, and he's the one who introduced Danny and I. We're both Danny, but the saxophone player Danny. And he wrote me a few days ago, how come when I do interviews, I never mention that he introduced us? So I always start this story when we started, I guess, what we call Marvin now. But the truth is, the way me and Danny met is through this bassist, Elad Muscatel. And the story is just, I graduated from Berklee in 2007. And Danny was still in the IDF in that time. He didn't go to music school. And we both were childhood friends with this bassist. And I came to Israel for a summer, just figuring out what next steps. And me and this bassist, who was friends with both of us, I brought a drummer from Berklee, and I knew this bassist, and he brought Danny along. And we got together for a rehearsal, basically a day before our first gig together. In Israel, and we just clicked. We started, and we had, over that summer, we had kind of a fusion band that we were, you know, played a few dozen shows in Israel. And then we moved together to Chicago, me and Danny, in 2008. And Marvin, the name Marvin is Markovich Rabin. Yes. And we started, that should be like an IQ test. People in the double digits never make that connection, you know, but yeah. So we started playing together. We started writing together, which I think is the real deep connection, you know, because you can play with anybody, but there are very few people a musician can write with, you know, when you can commit to ideas and decide on forms together and do things like that. We had that kind of connection. And yeah, we've been together ever since. It's, I don't know, 10 or 11 albums later. I can't even remember how much we have out with COVID more, because we've been making music from home. I actually took a break from working on an album to do this. We're doing another one.
Sorry to interrupt.
All good.
I guess the question is the form that this band has taken, this jazz rock fusion form. Mm-hmm. was the inspiration Pat Metheny? Was the inspiration Schofield? Like, what was kind of the inspiration for the form that y'all take?
Well, that's a good question. In terms of influence, Danny comes from straight up jazz and kind of came to fusion later on, like Michael Brecker, people like Brecker Brothers, and you know, things like that he got into. But really, mostly got into because that's what we were doing. So it was just checking out other people. He really came from Charlie Parker, mm-hmm. and Coltrane, and really, we both like really old swing, like Louis Armstrong and Sidney Bechet and all the gypsy jazz dudes like Django Reinhardt. I'm really deep into that.
Right.
That's actually the album I'm just working on. We're doing the gypsy jazz album. It's nuts. So there was that, and I came from really metal and rock and all the shrapnel kind of 80s players. And early on in my journey through music, it was really chasing that electric guitar sound, that sound of like a distorted guitar ripping through the music. I didn't even know that there were songs for the first 5 years of studying music. I would just fast forward to the guitar solo. I couldn't care less about the verses or the choruses of a song. I would just go straight there, study that, did not care. And really, I was just, the level of complexity in the playing kept kind of like dragging me deeper, but I was always interested in people who had similar types of approach to tone. So it started from, I don't know, Kirk Hammett, and then went to Marty Friedman, and then went to Steve Vai and Malmsteen, and then went to Greg Howe, and then to Scott Henderson and Alan Holdsworth, and like the high gain guys. And then after I kind of ran out of people, I started being more interested in people who played with a cleaner sound, like, you know, Schofield, Matheny, even though it took me a while to get into that, because there was a level, especially with Schofield, the level of sloppiness in the playing that, you know, coming from the rock world could be, you know, even listening to Charlie Parker, there's a lot of humanness that gets swept away the way people have made albums in the 80s, 1,000 takes or editing stuff out. So you're not used to hearing the slop and the human stuff in the music. But I got over that early on. And Matheny was a huge one. I mean, both our second and third album, we're playing with Paul Wertico and Steve Rodney from the Pat Metheny Group, and Russian Dolls we just put out with Antonio Sanchez on drums. So, I mean, that was a big hero. And early on, before we were a full-time touring band, when you make an album and you don't have a band that's a road machine yet, you are transcribing the reality of your imagination, because there's no reality of your reality. The band doesn't sound like anything. So you go to the studio, and time becomes, you know, rhythm becomes something very flexible. There's no real dynamic you're trying to capture, because, you know, even if you played with your band 100 gigs, you know, that's nothing. But if you play 1,000 gigs with your band, then there's something. And then the whole effort becomes capturing the thing that's already happening rather than generating the thing in the studio. So our first three albums, Marvin, Breaking the Cycle, and Last Chapter of Dreaming, were really, you know, dreamt up. You know, it was the last chapter of dreaming. You know, it was like, it was just, we were showing the inside of our minds. If we had infinite instruments, infinite people, kind of like a expensive Pat Metheny Group kind of sound. And after that, we were just a road band, and the CDs just became kind of trying to capture the quartet music.
How much of this is improvised and how much of it is written down? I mean, I would assume a live setting. Sorry?
Just the heads, just the melodies.
Just the heads, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's really, if anything is close to it, it's a bebop band, you know, because, I mean, I always say with the rhythm section, they're improvising. But if they play some shit I don't like, then they're going to hear about it. So they're free to do the things I like. And if they choose to do something I don't like, then I'll give them the freedom all over again. But they have to choose something that I can work with. You know, it's not a free, it's when you're playing live, obviously, you know, when you're playing shows or making a live album, you just have to accept whatever comes out. But if we're tracking an album, it's also a funny thing in a jazz context, you know, you play these songs, you know, hundreds of times, they all take a, you know, it's kind of like you're going home, but you're taking a different alleyway, a different road. You're looking at a different tree. Everything's changed. The seasons are changed. You know, every journey is kind of different. And then when you go to make an album, it's supposed to be some sort of conclusion of all the walks you've taken. But, you know, so you do something, but I mean, I tend to be much more judgmental when it's time to make albums.
I'm curious about how somebody goes from listening to Kurt Hammett or any of those really big guitar players of the late 80s and all that distortion and all. To me, it's noise, but I appreciate that to others it's not. Sure. How you go from that to what you guys are doing today and what's down on Shredding at Sweetwater or Aggressive Hippies or any of that.
Yeah, well, you know, the truth, there's a quality that I have that I think is very off-putting to your friends and people who are close to you, which is I can be really, really into something and tell everybody that it's the greatest thing, greatest shit since sliced bread. And one day flip. Just, it's over. I don't care. It sucks. You know, then on to the next thing. So I think that's really the what happened to me with metal. You know, one day I just put the uniform down, stopped dressing in black, and was like, you know, okay, but it's, obviously it's more gradual. I think studying an instrument, you know, studying music, wanting to go deeper. I mean, listen, man, if you're fascinated by a Metallica riff after playing guitar for 20 years, you're probably not doing too much growing, you know. And there is a refusal that's very prone in our culture of like people just rejecting language. And it's even true for us to an extent, you know, because we're musically literate, but compared to the level of musical literacy that was around, let's say 200 years ago, where, you know, you could just take a look at like, you know, orchestra, you know, practice and really piece together those sounds in your mind. Even the most sophisticated players nowadays are basically illiterate. So, you know, that's like the top notch of, yeah. of, you know, so we're in an musically illiterate world and, you know, we are somehow kind of more advanced, I guess, than the average Joe, but, you know, it's really egged on. People really make a mythology around ear players, the less you know, the more you feel type thing. And there's some truth to that, I guess, but, lazy people take it the wrong way as an excuse to never grow and to just be stuck in place and listen to the same sounds again and again, not realizing that, you know, that it's just the same thing.
So there's a musical progression in your background, but also musical progression, obviously, in your playing, like,
yeah,
to the extent where things are way more probably complicated or complex compared to the way they were in 2009 when Marvin came out, let's say.
Yeah, I think the complex, you know, it's funny, but like the kind of complexity that's built into improvisation, the reason we have soloists improvise is because there is a certain kind of complexity that is more lifelike, more organic in a solo than is possible when you sit down with a pencil and just try to kind of fish out a permanent melody. You just wouldn't commit to this level of chaos in your choice making. So, I mean, I think it was always like, you know, there's always that complexity in my playing because I really haven't fundamentally changed anything about what I do. I think what happens with time is actually that, you acquire, if anything, you know, you acquire more vocabulary. You just are able to connect your ideas or have things that are more kind of, you get more in touch with an internal logic that's guiding your lines and your ideas just from being able to relax. You know, I think the excitement of seeing somebody young, like early 20s or something, is just... Bukowski said this about people, and he said that the only interesting feature in people or animals is courage. You know, when you see that gazelle running away from the lion, you know, and it's like just an act of courage on all accounts. Yeah. And there's something like that. If there's no courage in the playing, if people aren't pushing the limit of their ability, and there's no risk that they're gonna crash, then it's just not interesting. It's nerd stuff. You're not interested. It's not good to go see somebody showing you their homework, no matter how well they did it at home. So when you're 20, there's just something where, you know, you haven't checked out so much, but you could be the kind of guy that's just trying, you know, and turning red and changing colors. And the attempt is so pure. I think that's really the drama of young players. But for older players, it's about knowing a lot and still pushing.
Yeah, you know? It's the danger, right? It's the danger of getting up on stage and figuring out. You hear the same thing from comedians who are like, sure, I might bomb tonight, but
right,
I'm going to get up and do it anyway. Right.
Right, right. If you're not just doing your old tired jokes, same set, you know, if you're just trying to still riff, still still take it somewhere, make it better. You know, that's really the attempt. That's the point of improvising. You try to make it better in front of people.
I'm curious too about the progressive rock thing. You mentioned Steve Howe, and there are others who are.
I said Greg Howe.
Greg Howe. Oh,
different Steve. Howe. Different Howe.
Different Howe. Okay. Well, progressive rock wise, because it does have that kind of, I don't want to say formula, but it does tend to grow. The songs tend to grow in a progressive rock kind of way. Again, intentional, or is that just?
Super intentional, but not because of our love for, okay, so I'm going to preface this. In Israel, you grow, our King Crimson is our Beatles.
Right.
Like, it's like in the Court of the Crimson King is probably the most listened to in bars album in Israel. Pink Floyd too. Like they're just, there's, you know, it's kind of like how that Sugar Man thing happened in South Africa. Like we had our own, still the same classic rock was big, but just the stuff people gravitated towards inside that category, inside that catalog when you came to the US makes no sense. You know, it's not the same kind of thing. So we grew up listening to a lot of that 70s thing, and it also really influenced the music. Like Yoni Rechter, is a known Israeli singer-songwriter, wrote a lot of songs for Arik Einstein. And you were mentioning Kavelet. Yes, is a huge influence on these guys. So it's like all the odd meter stuff, the extended form, the through composed structures, it's really a part of the pop we grew up with. So that's one thing. The other thing is that after Last Chapter of Dreaming, me and Danny got really sick of jazz forms. Which is, you know, for people who don't know, a jazz form is that you have the harmonic structure. Let's say it's a blues that's 12 bars long and that supports the melody. And then everybody kind of goes into that 12 bar room and changes the furniture around. You know, that's just the house is the architecture of the house is set, but everybody is an interior decorator who has a turn. And every chorus, you just do it again and again and again and again. And that creates this cycle. And all of jazz is built around these cycles. And for us, it was just getting exhausted to just have the form repeat. So we'd write ahead. And up to the last chapter, we had some songs that just had melodies, no solos. And then we had some songs to get away from it. The songs were shorter and we just have one solo, like Purple Fiddle, Danny soloing in the form, but we didn't want to do like a whole saxophone solo and then build the arrangement again with a guitar solo in the same exact form. So what we started doing really in Aggressive Hippies or really it's really from Goatman on, that's really the format, is that we would just put two songs together, make an interlude between them to connect them smoothly and to where the forms kind of have the, we don't necessarily solo on the things that the melody is on anymore. That's, we've freed ourselves from that. But also with the longer songs, it's just finding a way to put it together that is more through composed in the same way that progressive rock is. Now, to say that like Yes or bands like that are big influences or Rush, it's just not true. I never had a real connection, you know, to that kind of music. It always, I'm going to say something that is going to be off-putting to some people, but to me, it always sounded like the most complicated music that non-jazz musicians can make. You know what I mean? Because it's complex, in air quotes. Like a lot of the writing is just, it's the easiest things to think about and play that are hard. You know, like groups of seven, like, it's a lot of unisons, a lot of just really sort of simple things. But again, their level of complexity is compositional. For us, we're not interested in that kind of complexity. We're interested in simple backgrounds and complex focal points. They have complex backgrounds and simple focal points. The melody of like Tom Sawyer is a simple melody. What's going on behind it to support it is more complicated. And to me, that's not the kind of picture that we make, you know?
your music, whether it's you or Danny, is really about sort of building the bass and then having either of you solo on top of that. And mm-hmm. that's why the rhythm section for you guys is so important, because that's what allows you guys to sort of go off sure. wherever you need to go, right? Like,
yeah,
to keep that rhythm going, right?
Yeah.
Everett's a pretty hard hitter, though. I mean, it must be tough for you guys to sort of break through how hard, you know, he's playing.
We need that. We wouldn't be able to survive with a drummer that's kind of like, you know, Derek Trucks band type drumming, where everything starts super low and builds super logically, and like everything's kind of an obvious climax. That's not the nature of our music, really. You know, one of the bigger evolutions that happened in jazz music was really John Coltrane's band, and the way I think two things happened in music around the same time, which was like the interaction in Hendrix's band and the interaction in John Coltrane's band. And they're both really, in a way, bringing something from India into American music, which was the idea that you have a rhythm instrument that's chasing around the soloist and creating dynamic climaxes. And that's really a big part of our music. That feeling of like just the music spontaneously kind of reaching this climax and then shrinking in. That's usually the dialogue between the drums and the guitar, or the drums and the saxophone, catching things and really building things. And that has to be sort of spontaneous. In Charlie Parker's music or Django Reinhardt's music, it's, you know, which happened in the 30s, 40s, the solos don't build dynamically at all. They stay in one temperature. Everybody's just grooving and they're just playing lines through it. And if you just freeze a random spot in the solo, it's going to be on the same dynamic level. Everything, that's not the point of that music. And our music is sort of like that music harmonically. And in terms of how we think about, you know, unisons, but it's more like Coltrane's music in terms of dynamics.
Right. So you're more like an improvisational band, or the reason it caught my ear, I guess, is because this podcast and what I listen to is all geared towards jam bands, whether mm-hmm. that's the Grateful Dead or Phish or any of the more modern bands, but does have that layer of backbeat or rhythm, right, whatever you want to say. And then people like, you know, Garcia's often been mentioned in the same conversation as Coltrane. Mm-hmm. And I don't need to tell you about Anastasio and his sure. abilities as well. But it's kind of like, and Scofield too, obviously, it's kind of like the bass is set and then you guys can...
It's exactly that. And I think what's really in common with us in the jam world is the dynamic build. I think the big difference between us and them is the changes, you know? So we're always trying, or not always, we have some things that are just open jams and then really there are no differences. But for us, a lot of the time, we're just trying to reach those kind of climactic moments that I think a jam band really needs, either a blues or an open one chord thing to get to, where, you know, just everything's simmering. And really, you know, ideally you want to be as free over harmony as over a one chord thing, you know, to where it doesn't change your choice making just because there are changes coming.
You're a student of the game as much as anybody else is. And I've seen a lot of your video. Like I dug in real deep. I've seen a lot of videos online about you teaching uh-huh. chord structure and key and tuning and all kinds. Is that the passion, teaching people and learning new things, or is the passion is playing your own original?
I honestly can't make my, you know, I'm as far from a saint as it could be. Everything I do for teaching is really to promote our music. I get off on the idea that people sit at home or come to a show and engage directly with the things I make, you know, whether that's live or through a recording. But that was the goal. The goal is to get Marvin, you know, more known. And And I don't think there's any shame in it. Actually, I have a lot of students, and I think it's pretty clear to them that if they want to get great at guitar, that's on them. And, you know, and I'm here to help. I'm happy to help. But I can't say that I feel some sort of great joy when somebody really figures out how to play over a bebop song or a fusion song. You know, I like to play over the fusion songs.
Yeah.
But you got to be honest with it. I mean, there are people who just love teaching, who vicariously live through their students, even that are great, accomplished players. So, yeah, I never really got to this place where, you know, I got off on somebody else's growth, which, you know, I'm always honest about. I think the best policy is just to kind of know yourself and tell your students who they're dealing with in advance.
Yeah. The pandemic has been difficult for everybody, I think.
Yes.
And as a jazz quartet, I would imagine most of the revenue comes from you guys playing.
And selling merch, yeah.
Yeah, selling merch, not making records, even though that's exciting.
Yeah.
How hard has it been for you guys the last year?
You know, we hard. I mean, we're not dead, so that's good.
yeah.
You got to keep it in perspective. Certainly challenging. The most challenging thing about it is what it does to the playing field, to where everything now is YouTube, Facebook, Bandcamp, and the amount of power that these people all of a sudden have on our lives. We were really in a place where we were shaping our own destiny. We'd get in a van. We never had management or booking. We would book our own 250 shows a year. We would book ourselves. We would always be on the road. We'd always be, you know, and it really was a very free kind of existence. It wasn't easy, but, you know, I feel like we used the time well. Me and Danny and I, we did two tours of backyards of our fans. We would just go, we went all over the States. We just charge kind of a set fee to just come there, play standards for, like, you know, people's families and friends in their backyard, and set up our own PA, rent a car, like a little car, and just do it, the two of us. So I think in 2020, we played like 100 and something shows like that, which wasn't bad. You know, we made good money and figured something out. And we made Russian Dolls, which is Danny's album. Really, he wrote all the songs on that, and I just played bass and guitar. We had Antonio Sanchez play drums, and I didn't take one solo. First time in my life for a record. It was very difficult. And then I made an album called 10 Years in the Sun, which is all solo guitar, which was amazing to make. Just really interesting because I'm not a finger picking guy at all. And I made a resolution that I'm going to make a solo guitar album. And there's going to be no edits on it. It's just one mic, a couple of guitars. And, I mean, just one track per song played through, just getting away from, like, you know, the temptations of modern editing and technology. And, you know, spent a few weeks writing all these tunes or arranging our old songs. There's 14 songs on there. And, you know, for like 2 weeks, I just did one song a day. And some of these, man, like the first song on the album, it's like kind of flamenco-y. And I don't have the chops for it. I just don't, you know, I cannot play that style of music. So it's just, you know, doing it's psychologically exhausting. I think it took me like 95 takes to get that one. And I would get so far and play it perfect. And in my mind, I'd be like, you're going to fuck up. It's like 3 minutes in, like, you don't hit any weird notes. And then it's just before the end, just hit something there. Oh, and again and again, it's like the more you do it, the more you battle with this thing. So it was interesting to be in this place of not having the abilities necessary to really do the song, and then just being in the state of struggle. You know,
typically what kind of venues do you play? Like, are you mostly playing jazz clubs? Are you playing festivals?
Rock clubs, mostly. Yeah. And when we go to like Bumfuck, which we do often, we just go to whatever's around. You know, some places like on, you know, like Southern Texas near the border, there's, you know, you just have dive bars and we go there and we basically rent the room and it's like a metal bar or something. But our audience is super diverse everywhere, just people from really, you know, bikers, hippies and metalheads and jazz people. That's kind of like a strange thing. They all come and we do play in the jam scene. We're doing some kind of jam in Schuylkill in Pennsylvania, April 30th. We've done a lot of festivals, disc jam when that was still a thing.
Yeah.
Everybody knows about that. We would love to do more things in the scene, but you guys have some hard times coming too. Jesus Christ, that EDM is really eating you up, huh?
I'm curious about your fans because I posted a video, Arkansas
Jumper. Yeah.
And the reaction to it was overwhelming.
Really?
Yeah, there was like 200 likes. It was huge. It was one of our biggest posts for a band that is outside of the scene, for sure. And what was curious about it was, like you mentioned, you have all kinds of different fans who are into different kinds of music. But what I also found fascinating is lots of people from around the world, not just North Americans. We're not just Americans, actually. Is that a big thing for you too, to sort of spread your wings outside of North America?
We play, you know, since we mostly drive to our gigs, we played a lot of Canada dates and we did some Mexico, which was hilarious to drive into. And we played a festival in Colombia a few years ago. But yeah, Europe we've never done. And we do have an audience there, but, you know, it's... you know, we own our own van. We have a lot of heavy gear to like go there and rent a car and rent the gear. We've never had the assurances that things are, that we're not going to like, you know, come back just totally screwed.
Is the plan to continue in this form, the four piece? Have you guys ever thought about expanding beyond the four of you? Not really. You're pretty comfortable with.
I love it. Yeah. I mean, I really hate keys. I always hated keys in fusion. I feel like they ruined everything for everybody with those synth sounds. You know, they took it from like this temperature of like Mahavishnu Orchestra.
Yeah.
Where it was like, you know, even like Weather Report, you know, obviously Zawinul played keys, but like there was a certain, you know, there was a certain attitude in the music and they were basically rock stars. And then a decade later, it's like the fucking Hawaiian t-shirts and the calculator watches. It's like, what are you doing, dude? The mixture of the synth 80s texture and this kind of music that really, you know, took over and became kind of country club music to where really fusion became a really profane kind of thing. Like you don't want to say fusion, you know, when you're promoting yourself. Like we often call ourselves jazz rock just to disassociate with, you know, with a lot of these hokey guys.
Right. You're always learning and you're always putting out new stuff. Apparently you're working on the Django Reinhardt stuff. Is the four piece is all four of you or just?
No, it's me, Danny, and our bassist is playing upright bass on
right.
it, John, and no drums. Cause that, right. style music doesn't have drums.
Yeah.
But it's coming out so good. Like really, I'm telling you, we're doing like a lot of the, you know, the kind of unison stuff that we typically do just in that genre. I couldn't be happier, honestly, with how it's coming out.
Cool. Yeah. This thing ends eventually and you'll be out on the road doing, the plan is to do 250 dates again, right?
Well, we're going in April again for like, we have a few days and then we're doing another backyard thing. But yeah, hopefully as soon as possible, we're happy to go.
And you have all this material, right? That you've been,
writing. Yeah, we have our whole album that we never ended up making because we were just the way we make albums is that we play a lot of shows. Like, you know, Strong Thing, we played those songs for a year. We went to the studio to make that album. That's our last really studio album, like Shredding and Sweetwater is a live album.
Yeah.
That doesn't count. And you know, we just went in for one day in the studio and did it. It took one day, and then, you know, one day to mix. There was nothing to redo. Everybody knew how to play, you know. It's like you want to go in so familiar.
Is it when you're making those records, is it live off the floor, or is there a lot of overdubs, or
no,
or is
overdubs it just, really?
Yeah.
Or if we take an overdub, we take a slice of the entire band. You know what I mean? Like, we might take like a few takes on a song, but if there's a part of a solo that I like, I'm taking the bass and drums with me and making that work, you know? But not really with the more the years progress, it's, you know, I feel like a part of not that I'm, you know, I'm not as old as some people, but, you know, a little bit of like learned wisdom is the difference between accuracy and perfection. You know what I mean? You just, a lot of things that you feel, that make you feel very naked, tend to be the good things, you know, and you can't really, I mean, now at the age of, you know, Snapchat filters, it's not like anybody's into the makeup you put on yourself sonically too. You know,
right.
I mean, there's a certain amount of polishing and a certain amount of like cleaning up the sound that's just necessary. But I think with great power comes great responsibility. That's a Spider-Man's uncle quote. You know, you really need to be responsible using these tools that allow you to fuck with time. You know, that's really what a Pro Tools rig does. It allows you to go back and fix things in time. You can't fix things and you do that. And it's like one of those Mayan curses, like an Indiana Jones movie. You open this Pandora's box and you think you're making it better. But a lot of the times, the things you are unknowingly removing from the music are the things that really make it human. And at the end of the day, if we liked quantized music, we'd already let those computers generate it and listen to that. But that's not really the story.
It is the difference between that metal rock and jazz in many ways, right? Like playing the idea, not necessarily note for note, or and allowing yourself to be dangerous within that form.
And understanding where your freedom is rhythmically. You know, when you listen to, it's funny, but even when you listen to an old pop singer like Sinatra, the improvisation rhythmically is there constantly. Meaning if you listen to two takes of All of Me and you just look at where the notes are, not what the notes are, they're in very different places intentionally every time. And that's rhythmic improvisation is just as much an improvisation as note choice improvisation. Meaning the difference between All of Me or All of Me or All of Me, right?
Right.
You're free syncopating to throw that, to throw these notes around in time. And that's really a big part of, you know, understanding your freedoms in music.
I'm fascinated by the conversation and I'm fascinated by the music and the story, really. continued success, and we're fans now, so we'll be watching and listening, and hopefully you'll come up to Canada and to Toronto soon, or we'll catch you down south sometime. And continued success, and continue doing what you're doing. I mean, if it's making you guys happy, it sounds great, and to my ears it does. Keep doing what you're doing, man. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it, Ira.
A great discussion about music and what Danny and the rest of Marbin are trying to do sonically and rhythmically. For more on Marbin, visit marbinmusic.com. Before we leave you, how about we check out another track from Shreddin' That Sweetwater? Here is Escape from Hippie Mountain.
You've been listening to The Sound Podcast. Technical production by Adam Karsh and Andrea Ruse. Inspired by the music we love. For more, visit thesoundpodcast.com.